Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. On October 1st, 2017, at the National Gallery of Art, Julia Bryan Wilson joined Lynn Cook to discuss the publication of Frey, Art and Textile Politics, which explores textiles and their role at the forefront of debates about process, materiality, gender, and race in times of economic upheaval. Closely examining how amateurs and fine artists in the United States and Chile turned to sewing, braiding, knotting, and quilting amid the rise of global manufacturing, Bryan Wilson argues that textiles unravel the high-low divide and urges us to think flexibly about what the politics of textiles might be.
Good afternoon and welcome. Thank you for coming. My name is Lynn Cook. I'm Senior Curator for Special Projects in Modern Art, and it's my pleasure to welcome Julia Bryan Wilson here this afternoon and to celebrate with you the publication of her latest book, Frey, Art and Textile Politics. I'm not going to do a long introduction other than to say Julia is professor in the Department of History of Art at the University of California, Berkeley, and she's published a number of books. To follow up on her biography, go to Wikipedia and follow those sources. There are many entries. But I wanted to give as much time as possible to thinking about this book. It is not only in my opinion, but in those of colleagues who've read it, really a landmark book, both in terms of histories of the intersection of art as in fine arts and crafts, but for the larger issues it raises, and I hope these will come out during the discussion. The format we've chosen is that Julia will begin by reading from the book and giving a brief outline of its structure and composition for about 15 to 20 minutes, and then we'll turn to a conversation. So please join me in welcoming Julia.
Well, thank you so much to Lynn and to everyone at the National Gallery. I'm really delighted and honored to be here. And thank you all for coming on this very, very beautiful Sunday afternoon. I'm going to read, as Lynn said, for directly out of the first pages of the introduction, and then I will provide a very short overview of some of the main themes and issues of the book, and then we will, Lynn and I will have a conversation together. I will say just very quickly as sort of preliminary words, perhaps, that the book is intentionally and polemically meant to be accessible to many kinds of readers, and I hope you get a sense of that from these opening pages. Around 1974, the mock organization Lady Sewing Circle and Terrorist Society emerged out of conversations within a small feminist consciousness-raising group in Eugene, Oregon. The women in the group laughed among themselves about putting their faux moniker on a t-shirt, but none took concrete action until writer Sally Jo Bowman drew up a design. She based her sketch on an embroidery pattern that included a stem of flowers with open petals and striated leaves, hoping that the sweetness of the motif would drive home the stark juxtaposition between the presumed harmlessness of the sewing circle and the menace of the terrorist society. The resultant logo, with its deceptively innocent flower motif and a crypto-Celtic meets Art Nouveau typeface, came to be emblazoned not just on t-shirts, but on coffee mugs, stickers, and buttons. The circularity of the design functions conceptually as well as formally. It breaks the phrase into two grammatical and visual parts, leading to greater payoff as you first read the prim top portion, Ladies' Sewing Circle, and then your eyes swing down for the surprise of the punchline, and terrorist society. What does it mean to imagine the sewing needle as a dangerous tool or to envision female collective textile making as a process that might upend conventions, threaten state structures, or wreak political havoc? The joke relies upon assumptions about the very impotence of textiles and the assumed absurdity of decorous ladies, not women, but their more dainty counterparts, fostering violent unrest. Made within the context of a specific historical moment in the United States, as the women's liberation movement of the 1970s was nearing its crescendo and the Vietnam War was coming to its bitter end, the slogan captures a bit of sly feminist humor regarding the unlikelihood of feminist groups, of textile groups, fomenting illegal, dangerous action. Bowman took her design to a local t-shirt company known for making sports shirts and had 24 shirts silkscreened. They were a hit with the consciousness-raising group, so she shopped them around to women's conventions, where, according to her, they sold like hotcakes. Casting a sewing circle as insurrectionary might be the engine of the design's comedy, but the shirt's immense popularity points to a serious desire to rethink feminist collective textile making as world-changing. For about a decade, Bowman, based in Fall Creek, Oregon, sold the t-shirts through mail order, advertising primarily through small print classifieds in the back of Ms. Magazine. "You're sure to entertain and invite comments too," stated one version of the ad. Bowman placed her design under copyright in 1977, and though she never made anything close to a living with the shirts and stickers and buttons, it became an iconic item within 1970s material culture, feminist material culture. Many of you might own a t-shirt just like this, or a handbag, I mean a tote bag or something. They're still in circulation. Bowman sold the copyright in 1986 after the t-shirt business dwindled, but in recent years the logo has been revived and placed on an array of objects by younger feminists, cashing in on its enduring cleverness, as well as its nostalgia for a different era, one in which women's rights might be taken seriously while at the same time terrorism might be invoked lightly. In the intervening years, the connotations affiliated with the label terrorist have changed. Then it signified homegrown radicals such as the Weather Underground, whose manifesto Prairie Fire urged armed struggle against US imperialism and advocated for militant anti-capitalist, anti-racist, and anti-sexist politics, causes endorsed by many on the left, even if their tactics were controversial. Published in 1974, contemporaneous with Bowman's t-shirt, Prairie Fire includes a section on feminist liberation and describes undervalued textile and garment labor as the traditional work of women. These and other traditions were to be shattered. Some revolutionary feminists embraced the very rhetoric of extreme violence that was satirized by the Ladies' Sewing Circle, demonstrating that there was not as much dissonance at the time as is felt today by the alignment of feminism and so-called terrorism. I know the Ladies' Sewing Circle and Terrorist Society t-shirt intimately because my mother bought one in 1977 after seeing the ad in Ms. She was an early subscriber when I was a young child in Texas. While I was growing up, the t-shirt was in steady rotation in her wardrobe, and I have somewhat mortified memories of her wearing it, provoking consternation and stilted smiles among a few less than amused storekeepers, church members, and school teachers. This was in Canyon, Texas, a tiny town outside of Amarillo, where people wasn't considered that funny. I badly wanted to include a photograph of my mom in the t-shirt from those years, but no such image exists. "I was a single parent, Julia. I was always the one behind the camera," she reminded me after looking through her photo albums. As a committed feminist, my mother considered the Ladies' Sewing Circle t-shirt especially funny because she was also a dedicated sewer who had an ingenious knack for textiles. Throughout the 1970s and 80s, she handmade many of my family's clothes because it was far cheaper than buying new things and because she was good at it. It's no longer true that it's cheaper to make things because of fast fashion, throwaway fashion, but in the 70s, it was definitively a way to save money. In other words, she sewed for reasons of class-based expediency rather than ideology. And she taught me how to sew the summer I turned 13. Under her guidance, I made a few awkward outfits. Though I was never very good, this exposure made me curious about textiles from the perspective of making. When I was in high school and coming into my own feminist politics, I borrowed the t-shirt from my mother so frequently that she finally gave it to me. Like her, I reveled in the puzzled looks it elicited. I wore it too because it felt palpably vintage, and as such signaled my ironic affiliation, akin to what Elizabeth Freeman has called temporal drag, with the outdated or bygone era of my mother's generation, who, unlike my friends or me, might have earnestly self-identified as sewers. So though she was sincerely and proudly a sewer, I did not quite grasp that she would have considered sewing circles anachronistic. To me, 70s feminism was sort of just like the Victorian era, and just all kind of in this blurry sense of, you know, way back then. So anyway, I was wearing it as a teenager circa 1990 signaled my absolute allegiance to feminism while at the same time distanced me from what seemed to me a long time past. The 1970s version of women's liberation, which to me existed in a realm between the familiar and the strange, as the quaint flowery design was transmuted into near cultic paraphernalia. But not every woman who wore Bowman's design in the 1970s and early 80s necessarily identified with progressive feminist politics. A 1981 article on the Republican Party National Field Director, Maxine Fernstrom, recounts that she turns heads when she bursts into a room wearing a mink coat over a sweatshirt that says Ladies Sewing Circle and Terrorist Society. With its evocation of a clash between luxurious fur and workaday sweatshirt, the description of Fernstrom as a Republican head-turner illustrates how the logo was open-ended enough to appeal to those from across the ideological spectrum. The t-shirt itself embodies a tension within textiles. They occupy a central place in traditionalist histories, while they also erupt as potential sites of resistance to that very traditionalism, claimed by competing factions at once as hegemonic and counter-hegemonic. It is exactly such tensions that this book explores, for expectations about textiles are thwarted depending on which histories and which objects one examines. The first scholarly book of its kind, Frey takes up key moments from the 1970s, 80s, and 90s, in which textiles were put to work in a range of circumstances, often intertwining activist and artistic purposes, and sometimes tattered or tore under the pressure. I attend closely to the forms, processes of making, materials, and aesthetics of the following subjects: the campy, crafty costumes of the Coquettes, the braided rag rug sculptures of Harmony Hammond, the ephemeral threads of Cecilia Vicuña, the burlap-backed tapestries of the Chilean arpilleras, and the hand-sewn panels of the AIDS quilt. As will be made clear, this close looking constitutes both my art historical methodology and my political project. Throughout, I use the word fray in several senses: the material wearing out of textiles, the undoing of threads, the pulling apart of fibers through strain and repeated use. Edges or borders are more prone to fraying as they are subject to more friction. I'm theoretically indebted to Roland Barthes' understanding of the fraying of textual meaning. He eloquently describes the shared etymological roots of textiles and texts, from the Latin to weave, as at once interwoven and unfinished. Often used as tactile forms of communication or kinds of writing, textiles offer themselves as objects to be understood, but as with any system of language, they are dense with multiple meanings and available for a range of readings and conflicting interpretations. Textiles are thus also in the fray of heated disputes, controversies, and disagreements, and have been at the center of arguments about the materiality of gendered labor. Those debates are often about the limits or boundaries between high and low, since textiles, not least because of their constant use in and affiliation with the everyday, trigger suspicions that such boundaries might not exist. Nerves and tempers also fray. While it is said that one should rise above the fray, this book chooses to dwell in its sometimes uncomfortable place of forceful confrontation. For I take as my central subject fractious disputes about what and how textiles mean, where they should live institutionally, and where they belong politically. As with the many definitions of fray, I also consider the term textiles in its most capacious sense, to refer to everything from needle-based techniques like applique to mass-produced clothing, while maintaining important distinctions between the various processes and their effects. The word textiles and terms denoting their constitutive elements, fibers such as cords, twine, and yarn, are sometimes used interchangeably. Within the practices I'm investigating, those classifications are not always rigidly defined and are sensitive to purpose. At times, fiber is organized into fabric, but it often remains a coil or a jumble. Some of the objects in this book are only marginally handmade. They integrate commercial factory fabricated items along with string or cloth scraps as they probe the various thresholds of textiles between hand and machine, or between states of becoming and processes of unmaking. In Frey, I discuss select instances in which textiles from the 1970s to the 90s, in art as well as non-art contexts, have been marshaled for their specially tensile properties, that is, their capacity to be pulled, stressed, and withstand tension, sometimes to their breaking point. The book is episodic and makes no claims for encyclopedic or global coverage. Instead, I elaborate on a handful of potent moments of textile making in the United States and Chile, and I say more in the introduction and throughout the book about why those two countries. Organized around a series of focused cases that examine both amateur practices and those destined for fine art audiences, Frey considers the classed, race, gendered, and sexualized formations that have surrounded and critically produced textiles since the 1970s. For me, by far the most important, ambitious, and risky aspect of the book is its organizational structure, in which chapters are broken into two parts, giving equal consideration to hobbyist and fine art practices while also undoing the logics of the categorizations of high and low. rather than adopt a binary scheme in which amateurism is defined oppositionally against professionalism, I understand these as ever-mobile terms in a broader, flexible matrix that admits a range of collective and individual production by all kinds of self-proclaimed textile makers. The book structurally asserts how, in the case of textiles, fine art and amateur practices are mutually co-constitutive, constantly informing each other. I also include occasional moments of autobiographical disclosure, because I believe that accounting for textiles, objects that are in close physical contact with us at virtually every minute of the day, demands alternative methodologies, ones that extend from shared intimate knowledge. Regardless of specialized education or technical vocabulary, by virtue of wearing garments, sleeping amongst linens, and sitting on upholstered surfaces, we are all de facto experts in textiles, attuned to subtle distinctions in their variable heft, durability, and breathability. Before they reach school age, children know which fabrics itch, which are smooth, which are warm. I honor the lay expertise, personal proficiency, and tacit intelligence abundantly displayed every time I see people perform the simple but effective gesture of rubbing cloth between their fingers to distinguish texture, thickness, and suppleness. We undergo a lifetime of training in order to be keenly attuned to the material property of textiles. And when I write about my own encounters with these objects, I affirm the importance of what I call an amateur method. So that's part of the introduction. It goes on for probably 40 more pages, so there's much more to be said. But I'm going to turn now and provide just the very briefest of sketches of how the book is organized. And as I said, every chapter, well, the first two chapters are broken into two parts, and I've sutured or stitched together a hobbyist formation of textiles alongside a fine art formation of textiles. So I'll just walk us through and then what those chapters are. I start with explaining what I mean by textile politics, and I use the word textile here almost like a verb, so to provide texture to politics. I think that one of the, that there have just been so many opposing arguments about the political valences that textiles can take, and what the book really sets out to do is to claim that textiles are always contingent. They're always going to be pulled in multiple directions at once based on historical context and specific receptions. So neither, I don't think it's fair to either claim them for kind of conservative purposes, nor to claim that they're inherently radical, and those claims have been made, but rather we have to really attend to their forms and means and moments of making. A very important touchstone for my book was the Black feminist artist Faith Ringgold, one of the many feminist artists in the early 1970s who were turning to textiles precisely as a reclamation of formerly denigrated women's work and using cloth, fiber, yarn, and traditional piecing techniques to make a statement about the classist, sexist, and racist standards of quality, which did not admit textiles to the fold of the Fine Art Museum in that moment. It's also really important to me that I think about how the fine art resurgence for feminist artists like Faith Ringgold, it coexisted with a hobbyist surge in textile making. So this is an example of some of the material culture from that kind of embrace of textile materials, a magazine called Mad About Macrame. And this is the kind of thing that now it seems very silly to us, like a macrame owl could not feel more kitschy, I guess, or low. But for me, it's very important to think about how the audiences for a show of someone like Faith Ringgold would have been the women who also subscribed to a publication like Mad About Macrame, and to really take seriously, again, the fact that these hobbyist and these fine art registers are constantly informing each other. The first chapter stitches together an examination of the gender queer theater troupe based in San Francisco called the Coquettes. It looks at their costumes, which were all handmade in very dazzlingly inventive ways, as you can see here, next to the fine artist Harmony Hammond, who made a very important series of breakthrough works using braided rag rugs that then she painted and put them directly on the ground. so that they really do, you know, there is a relationship to an actual braided rag rug, which is, again, a kind of amateur form of making. And I think in this chapter a lot about the use of camp in these textiles, and also the kind of queerness of both the coquettes with their fabulously embellished glitter and sometimes falling apart at the seams, you know, concoctions, and Harmony Hammond's turning to this spiraling crafted formation precisely the year that she came out of the closet as a lesbian, and what might it mean to kind of claim for this this method of making a kind of queerness. In chapter two, I turn to Chile, a country that I have a long relationship with. I've lived there. I lived there in college for a semester, and I've visited many times. And I was hoping to expand our notion of what American art might look like by really thinking about a kind of conversation between Global South and Global North practices. And in this chapter, I examine the works of Cecilia Vicuña, who's a Chilean artist and poet who turned to textiles in the wake of the coup against Salvador Allende by Pinochet in 1973, and made a whole series of objects that were kind of these unraveling textile assemblages. And her practice I set against the work of women making these appliques that are known as arpilleras, who started these practices in kind of collective workshops in Santiago. They spread throughout Chile, again under the Pinochet dictatorship. And these were depictions, sometimes very graphic depictions, of torture or other hardships faced by because of the repressive dictatorship, that were meant to be smuggled out of the country and sold as sort of forms of testimony, visual testimony. And it's a fascinating archive. This one, you can see it actually says here, torture happens here, here torture happens, and people are being electrocuted, which was a form of torture under Pinochet. And these, I'm not claiming that there's some kind of causality here or necessarily even a mutual awareness. Vicuña might have owned an arpillera like this, but it's not, you know, I'm not trying to claim some kind of influence, but merely asserting at a structural level the fact that I want to take seriously both art that was made by people who considered themselves artists and wanted to make work destined for a gallery or museum context, and also textile work that was made by people who did not at all consider themselves artists and never imagined that their work might end up in a gallery or a museum. It was really a completely different sense of what the audience might be there. And in order to really assert my interest in amateur making, the entirety of my chapter three focuses on the NAMES Project AIDS Memorial Quilt, the world's largest communal art project, one that has kind of suffered from its success. It's now too big to ever be shown in its entirety. It's in storage in Atlanta, Georgia. These are images that I took in my many visits there. And it's a long chapter. I say a lot of things about many aspects of the AIDS quilt, but one of them is that it was a very controversial, I mean, we think of it now as just like a kind of, you know, one of the more successful activist practices of the AIDS era, because it brought so many people into the conversation. It really kind of made the HIV crisis, gave it a face, it made it personal, there was, you know, affiliations with warmth, you know, it has been seen by some 15 million people, but at the time, in the moment of its creation and in the first displays, it was really very contested, and not just from kind of conservative quarters and homophobic quarters, but also it faced a lot of attacks from ACT UP and Queer Nation, precisely because I claim it was a textile. And there were some feelings that the kind of softness or the pliancy and the lowness and the kitschiness were absolutely inadequate to face and confront the searing losses faced by the queer community. I don't have a conclusion. I was just telling my friend Bibi, we had lunch today, I was like, the book comes to no conclusions, but I do have an afterword where I return to some of the questions that I raise in the introduction about the origins of the book for me, which was about this term called craftivism that was coined basically around 2000, a kind of snappy conjunction of craft plus activism, and just some of the questions that I have about what that that emergence of that term and how it's been circulated. And I look at some very literal unravelings or examples of the fraying of textiles, like William Popel's Trinket, which is a flag, especially made flag, that he has installed with these very high-powered fans that whip it constantly until the stripes fall apart. And it's a very brilliant, I think, allegory for race relations in this country. And I also put in conversation a series of artists who working today who are genuinely engaging with amateur crafters, especially through the internet. So Stephanie Sihuko, who's a colleague of mine at Berkeley, who did this very brilliant project where she posted instructions for how to bootleg your own Chanel or Louis Vuitton bag, and then people crocheted these really lumpy, clearly handmade versions in order to raise questions about whose hands really do make these objects and how differently valued, you know, how expensive they can be, but how very undervalued that labor has been. So that is, again, an extremely fast overview of a book that's 325 pages. So that's just to give you the slightest sense of kind of where it came from and where it ends up. I think we're going to turn to our conversation now. And I have, if we need this clicker, I'll bring it along in case there's something to refer to.
Thanks, Julia. Can you all hear? Great. If I'm not misparaphrasing you, I think you said the other day that this is the first book you've written, or this is the book that the first time you've had the opportunity to write the book, a book, the way you really wanted to write it. Can you say what that meant?
Yes. That's. Thank you for starting there. Actually, that's. that gives me the opportunity to feel, you know, to say things I don't usually say because they're not very academic about, you know, it's not necessarily about content. But my first book, you know, was my dissertation book, and I had a lot of, one is somewhat constrained or fettered by expectations about professionalism and especially about voice mm-hmm. and authority. You really have to muster all your objectivity, I guess, in that moment and prove yourself. I felt a lot of compromises, I think, because of that. And the subject matter, which was about my first book was about artistic labor in the Vietnam War. And I did have very personal connections with a lot of what I was talking about, but that had to be absolutely an undertone, you know, was excluded from the actual text. It was really pushed, it wasn't even in the margins. It was nothing, it was absent, entirely absent. And I think that this book I felt in part because of the subject, because of what I'm claiming to be this amateur method that I'm invested in, I had to get personal. It seemed essential or urgent in a way. I chose the case studies, I chose them, but in some ways they also chose me. They're all, I've had personal encounters with some part of all of the subjects of the book. So when I lived in Chile in 1994, someone that was a friend of mine had been a sewer in one of the workshops. She had a little store, you know, a little kind of archive of arpilleras that she had collected. And so just happened to encounter them when I was in high school. I was part of a social justice organization that brought the AIDS quilt to my high school, and I helped fold it and participate in that ceremony. I also helped sew a panel for the people in my high school. I went to an public arts high school, so we actually did have quite a few people who, teachers and students who died of AIDS, and we made this terrible, so ugly panel with literally the comedy and tragedy masks, you know, because it's really, boy. but it was sweet. I mean, not just sweet, but actually so moving, you know, very. So I think what I meant when I said this is the first book where I've gotten to say what I wanted to say is really it's the first book that I feel like I've been able to surface my investment. Mm-hmm. And that investment comes across, not just in the autobiographical disclosures, but I also feel like I was able to sit with the subject for long enough and have the complexities really emerge. I mean, when I first started this book, it had a totally different title, a totally different set of objects. It was gonna be a book about craftivism and just really make that, you know, yes, textiles are dissent. It was even called something like that. And that really, I went so far from that. You know, I ended up in such a totally different place from that. So I think I just gave myself license to not go with that first instinct or something. Yeah.
Right. I see what you say about textiles. We all have a knowledge of textiles in a very deep way, even if we don't pay much conscious attention to it. We're constantly exercising that knowledge. But I wonder if art history isn't following you, or there's a sense in which not maybe for the first book an art historian writes, where demonstrations of authority and objectivity need to be in place. But I think we're seeing in art history more recourse to a subject speaker. And I was asking a friend about it the other day, and she said, oh, well, that comes out of feminism. That must be the legacies of feminism. And I was thinking about when I first encountered it, and I wondered whether Rosalind Krauss's Optical Unconscious wasn't one of the earliest books. And if it is, it's certainly one of the earliest, then it would come out of deconstruction, structuralism, late Barth, not feminism. But I also think it's about subject positions, I suppose, and letting the reader know something about the investments of the author, and something about not having a kind of omniscient, authorial stance that we think of as, or I think of as relating to histories coming from somewhere up there. They're immutable and that cannot be negotiated. Can you say something about?
It's so true. I mean, I think definitely for me it comes out of feminism and thinking deeply about what a feminist methodology would look like and how the how a personal voice might lend special texture and give more resonance, in fact, rather than less, or actually increase authority. I mean, not that authority is probably not the right word, but just that increase a sense of the fact, you know, the deep knowledge that I do possess about this subject that, like you said, is actually kind of a lay expertise. It's not like I did not like reskill as a knitter to write this book. I mean, I had a friend teach me on the beach, and then I probably forgot everything about it. And I do know how to sew in the, you know, gauchos for when I was 13. But it's not like I don't come at this from that vein of expertise, and yet I am claiming for myself the terrain of the expertise that we all share. And that seems deeply feminist to me. I will say that one of my models was the queer theory and activism and writing of Douglas Crimp, I think above all, and he has a brilliant article about the AIDS quilt that was extremely influential, where he talks about ambivalence, the structure of mourning and ambivalence, and the structure, you know, his own feelings about the ambivalence that he felt about the quilt. And he talks about going and seeing it in DC and how, you know, just all the complicated feelings he had about seeing a panel for Foucault and seeing, you know, the names of people he knew kind of casually. And that, so I think it comes also out of queer methodologies very strongly. I hope it's true that art history has also perhaps admitted some of these voices. I'd like to think so. I certainly encourage my students to look at objects that aren't necessarily canonical and, you know, move in directions and take risks with their own work. I hope they think that. There's some in the room. Yeah, so maybe art history is also just a more permissible place than it was 8 years ago when I published Art Workers.
I'm interested that you should respond in some way by talking about the skills or the limited skills you have in knitting and crocheting or whatever. I would never expect an art historian to tell me that she painted or that she'd taken courses in bronze casting. We don't expect that. But there's this sense, or it seems that there's this sense with crafts that it's a much more contested terrain. And you talk quite a lot in the you make the point that you're really looking at hobbyist hobbyists making crafted objects, and high craft. I'm not sure that's
well,
a term
it's not
you
a book about
use.
Studio craft,
yes.
And it's not a book about fiber arts. That's true.
And I hadn't really thought about that internal divisions within the craft world, but given that they exist, can you say something about how you think the studio crafts, particularly pottery or weaving, say, how they complicate this or are not not part, why they're not part of the conversation.
Right. I mean, there was a very important book that I respect tremendously published by Elisa Author called String, Felt, Thread, The Hierarchy of Art and Craft in American Art, that is such a, like, is so comprehensive and convincing about the divisions. But, you know, why is it that Eva Hesse used fiber and showed in the, at the Guggenheim, and other people who were using fiber were shown in, you know, in kind of craft museums, and really talking about these categories of studio art versus fine art, you know, and how very similar materials were marshaled in really different ways and with different discursive apparatuses around them. So in some ways I felt like, well, that's already, that conversation, you know, I don't know, you know, I want to talk though about a different, so there's a hierarchy right there, art and craft, studio craft versus fine art, but really the realm of the amateur, which I take, you know, is, has become kind of an insult, but I think of it in relation to its root word, amare, which is to love, so it's work that that people do not expecting to be paid, but doing it simply because they take pleasure in it. Anyway, I thought, well, that's another binary that has really gone underexplored. I mean, the kind of that, and that this massive amount of work that is absolutely under the threshold of critical visibility for most versions of contemporary art history, what would it mean to really focus on that? Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, it's not like, I mean, I will say that, of course, material culture studies, American studies, many other disciplines that do look at hobby making, of course, it's not, but in the world of contemporary art history, it's not, it is, you know, that it's really not popular. It's, or it's not, it's just not a, it's not a topic that goes discussed very often. But can I say, can I go back to the first part of your question, which is about why would we expect that an art historian would know how to do these things? Yeah, it's a great question. I did feel nervous. You know, I did have my friend teach me on the beach precisely. I was like, I really should know how to knit if I'm going to talk about some of this stuff. But I think for myself, I have also pursued in my career an embodied form of making because I do think it gives me access to just description. Mm-hmm. So I wrote an article about this really well-known minimalist dance called Trio A, which was choreographed and performed by Yvonne Rainer. And I learned how to dance that piece over the course of some months from Yvonne Rainer. And it did give me a completely different system of language to think about it because I do know it now in my body. Well, I used to. You know, I performed it. And I'm working on a book right now about Louise Nevelson, and she uses a lot of chair legs, things that broken apart pieces of furniture, and I had a lot of questions about how those things work, and so I learned how to turn wood on a lathe, and precisely because I thought this is just going to expand my toolkit in a way. So I think, of course, it's not expected, and we don't, but why not? We should. I feel like we should ask the art historian to know how to paint.
If you're also looking at the that end of the spectrum of craft making that has to do with amateurs, there's the idea that they're not skilled. But the if you come at it from another perspective, and I'm thinking, for example, about the anthropologist William Ferris, he talks about fireside training, meaning that certain skills get passed down in communities, families. So it, in quilting, it, women would learn to quilt from their aunts, their mothers, and so forth. And so to say that the G's Bend quilters are somehow self-taught or untaught, or it's a nonsense because there are those. So
there's all these other lineages for and pedagogies.
Yes. Yeah. And so the notion of who's skilled or not, and it's it may be that quite often it's the middle-class woman with time on her hands who can has the leisure to take up craft, who is genuinely unskilled, who needs to learn it, whereas someone who's doing it either because it's a job, literally working in manufacturing, or they're doing it like a mother because it's it saves money and it's practical to make clothes. In some, by some measures, they're not unskilled at all.
Right. Yeah, it's really true. I mean, these debates about, there's so much to be said there. It's a rich question. I guess the skill, I do talk about these, a kind of alternative genealogy of teaching with the Coquettes, like a kind of queer family because they were teaching each other. You know, a few of them did really know how to sew and they had one sewing machine and there was a kind of skill sharing that happened there. And some of those things, I mean, they're wildly inventive, but also innovative, you know, and you could, I mean, I don't at all ever equate the amateur with the unskilled. Mm-hmm. I really hope to blur those boundaries altogether. Part of what I think is the lasting potency of a piece, of a project like the AIDS Quilt, is the fact that it admits every kind of making. And so a lot of it isn't even sewn. I mean, it is radically de-skilled in that it's hot glued, it's stapled. The woman who's the executive director currently of the NAMES Project thinks that approximately 80% of the panels are made by people who have never sewed anything before. So that, and I think that that gives it a kind of special charge, actually, to see the investment that goes into this that is really has to, you know, is starting from scratch, absolutely. I mean, there's just a lot. I think I'll stop there.
No.
Well, I guess I wanted to say one more thing about, I'll just talk a little bit about the Arbietas, because there's a lot of conflicting interpretations about skill in the Arbietas, most of which, just to reiterate, were, we don't know who made them. They were anonymously made, in part because of fears of censorship and retribution, because they are quite hard-hitting, and this is a moment of profound, you know, this is an extremely repressive dictatorship, and there were even some galleries set on fire who showed them, et cetera, in the moment in Chile. So they were not, most of them were not signed. There is like a small kind of subset where there's a distinct authorial voice, and you can really see, and there's like special collections of them in the Museum of Memory and Human Rights in Santiago, and you can tell, oh, that was, one was made by this one woman. They have like really distinct sets of proportions, et cetera. But some of them, there were thousands and thousands of these made. Some of them were made actually collectively, so in a workshop or assembly line fashion, and it was done that way precisely so that they could incorporate women who had never sewed before, and it was just an easy way, like, okay, you cut out mountains, like that's your job for today, you cut out mountains, and then you're gonna tack these things down, or you make the little dolls. So I think the question of skill is just so vast, and in a way, I think about it, but I'm also not that interested in it ultimately, or it's not one of the like key terms I'm really working with. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Can I ask you about another term that's not a term that you're working with? But it's particularly with the Arbietas, mm-hmm. It's a term that I can imagine could be used around them, and that's folk. In fact, you write at one moment, American art has long incorporated folk art as one of its proper fields of inquiry. Mm-hmm. And I found that very interesting. Mm-hmm. And as someone who's been working on self-taught folk, I kind of think it's not present. Uh-huh. So,
well, I guess I really meant the like hardcore like Americanists who, uh-huh. you know, think kind of uh-huh. where mm-hmm. it is. I mean, because of, according to some accounts, American art isn't high until we basically get to Pollock, you know, and everything right. before that is kind of in the, you know, is some version of the folk. Mm-hmm. So that's what I was thinking, is the people who really, like the professional identity of the American art mm-hmm. historian. Mm-hmm. You know, it's true that I don't ever say the word again. It's possible that I don't ever say the word folk again. Yeah, I mean, these terms are so, they're so loaded. Yeah, yes. And I think that they also can be so blurry that I'm not sure that term is not mobilized for me in a way that amateur is, I guess.
Yes, but it's not that I want to debate it particularly, but and given that these terms are very slippery, they're context and historically dependent, so one's constantly having to kind of grasp them and put them back in place. But something like that is, one would imagine a market for it outside Chile would be to see it in relation to folk traditions.
I mean, the truth is they were never understood as art. They've mm-hmm. never, they circulated to like gift stores in Denmark where you could also buy Tibetan flags. They were kind of curiosities from afar. And they also were very, you know, a lot of kind of American leftists collected them because they, you know, in solidarity with the anti-Pinochet movement, etc. But, you know, it's so that I often meet people who say, oh, I have one of those, of course, like the arpilleras were big, and you would buy them in kind of like non-profit gift stores, mm-hmm. which wasn't, I mean, where you might find a kind of folk art, you know, carving or something. They do have that, and they are folkloric. I mean, there's no question that that is like one of the adjectives you could use to describe them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And presumably they could morph into different strains mm-hmm. now in the post-Pinochet world. And have they?
No.
Really?
The last time I went to Chile, which was 3 years ago, the arpilleras for sale, there are still some people making them, even though, of course, Pinochet is out of power, and now he's even dead. And they're for sale in places like the gift store of the Museum of Memory and Human Rights, and they're exactly the same as the ones that were made 20 or 30 years ago. They have stagnated as a... The commitment to the form is unchanged, I guess I'll say. The commitment to the form has there.
Not just the form, but the content.
But the content. So there's ones that were literally, I mean, the exact identical to ones that were made 30 years ago about, you know, the collective soup kitchens that came out of the poverty of the Pinochet era, or ones demanding, like, where are the detained and disappeared, mm-hmm. these tribunals. And, I mean, I think that now they are, because they are made for a tourist, for a tourist audience, mm-hmm. and they were never made for tourists. They weren't sold in, you know, Chile. They were exported out. They were smuggled in between layers of clothing and circulated elsewhere. But now you go and like, oh, here's my piece of kind of that, you know, Chilean history. And that's what I have. I've owned several that I bought. And they are, you know, they just have a very different character. Mm-hmm. Right. Because you can, because now you, there's that thing of like, producing, you know, picking your artisanal good where you're getting the one that feels slightly different than the one that's for sale right next to it, and so it's unique because your sun is orange and that sun is yellow, but you know, of course they are all just like very minute variations on a theme, but you get to feel really special because you got the
right, which comes back to this neoliberal craftivist trending that's been going on, as you defined it, where it's kind of an entrepreneurial, individualized self-branding, making of things which actually conform to stereotypes.
I mean, I think one of my moments of disenchantment with the craftivism was going to some of these fairs, you know, these kind of maker fairs, and with very high profile political claims being made about what it might mean to like knit your own hat in this moment, and going and seeing that it was just stuff for sale that was, you know, bespoke custom baby onesies with a giraffe embroidered on it, and this is, how is this part of a revolution, you know, and that was at a fair called the Handmade Revolution, and I thought, we're not in a revolution here, it's just more things to buy, and more ways to feel unique about what you purchase, and also for the maker, you know, a way to kind of brand themselves as special. And there has been a lot of, we're not in that moment anymore, that kind of like the high craftivist rah-rah moment. We're now in a cynical backlash against it. And I think of Frey as kind of after the backlash. Now I'm really trying to historicize the moment and understand it for what it was, and also give it the respect that, you know, I do think that there are moments where we see that textile handicraft is mobilized in very, very powerful ways to make political points.
And do you see those in the pink?
Yeah, I thought that the pussy hat moment of the Women's March was really a vibrant example of how textile making can register, a groundswell of opposition. And I thought it was extremely impressive to see just the numbers of women and men and people who don't consider themselves either of those things wearing these hats, you know, and as a sea of dissent against this administration, and especially in contrast to the kind of mass-manufactured Make America Great hat. I thought it was like wonderfully organic, you know, and kind of like amazingly effective.
I'm going to switch a little bit to come to the question of labor, because for me that was one of the great threads. There are many, but a thread that ran through the book in ways that had so many permutations to it. And I'm thinking, there's a moment where you're talking about Harmony Hammond, who's the woman who made the braided rug rags. And that her studio is in the garment district, and the kind of ending of labor, a certain kind of manufacturing in New York in those years, at the moment where she turns to this, and this kind of pivoting of those two relations, and then it moves on through other examples. But you also link it back to the textile workers and to Marx and to the movement from making cloth at home to as the first industrialized goods, I suppose.
Right, yeah. I mean, my first book was, it's just a constant question for me, the questions of artistic labor. And I think especially when we're talking about textiles, that is the signature example of work, actually. So, you know, Marx and Engels, when they talk about industrialization, when they talk about alienation, exploitation, indeed when they talk about the factory, what they're talking about is textile mills. And metaphors of textile making are, you know, suffuse Marx's accounts of what it means to be a worker. That's the primary industrial mode that he's not only theorizing and critiquing, but also the language, it gives him a language with which to think through these questions of resistance and undoing. So I do start there in my introduction, and then I am really interested in the moment of the early 70s, which is where I begin, not only because of the reclamation of craft materials by feminist artists, and not only because of the birth of queer liberation in the US, and not only because of the coup against Allende by Pinochet and the kind of implementation of neoliberalism in Chile, but also because of this incredible transition in terms of garment manufacturing, and how that is, the 70s really is the moment when the textile industry undergoes this very rapid change in character. And Harmony Hammond is scavenging her rags from the garment district precisely as it is moving into a much more, you know, precisely as those kind of sweatshops are being taken away and moving to the US South or moving overseas, et cetera. So I'm glad that you picked up on that, because that was a very insistent, persistent theme for me. It's really vital.
And I'm interested that it comes back into the most recent practices of younger artists. And do you have the image of the woman who's working, making objects in like a blender, the kinds of objects that are assembled across the border in these maquiladoras?
Right, I don't, but yeah, I have in my afterword, I have a section where I am looking at primarily female artists of color who are thinking about precisely are thematizing global outsourcing and feminized labor through their textile work. And what Lynn is referring to is the Mexican-American artist Margarita Cabrera, who makes these kind of Oldenburg-like soft sculptures with the threads, though, very visible. And she often reproduces objects that are made in factories on the border of the US and Mexico, and it has especially thought critically about the kind of femicides in Juarez, and anyway, she makes these very stark allegorical works about that.
I think in some ways the same point can be made about the artist who posted the means to make mock Chanel bags, and it's the fact that and you make it also with a photograph from, I think, a Reebok factory, women assembling sneakers, and the amount of hand labor that's in those, and if they're embroidered or embellished in different ways, that there are different, again, and it comes back to different notions of skill, but some kinds of skill are very visible, and some kinds are not. And with the luxury goods, there's one end of the fashion world where, you know, lace embroidery in the couture world is highly visible, and those people, or the person who does feathers, New York Times did a story about, or the New Yorker very recently, about one of the three or four people left who embroiders garments with dyed feathers and so forth. So there's that level of extraordinary hand-making within these very expensive objects, but there's another level of hand making that's going on, and that's done by scores of women whose work is just not recognized.
Absolutely, yeah. And the photograph, which is there's an image of women wearing pink in a Reebok factory making shoes. It was just a news image that I got, and it has to stand in for so much, of course, and it's a very inadequate representation of this entire global feminized workforce. But they are at sewing machines, and they are using threads and needles, and it is meant simply to say that there are so many different kinds of textile handmaking, and some of them have been very vaunted as politically progressive, but in fact that most of everything that we buy in terms of what we wear and how we sleep and what we sit on are made by some touch of the hand. It's just that those hands are so vastly undervalued and underpaid that it's very critical to keep in mind that the craftivist conversation arose, right in tension, I think, with questions about sweatshop labor, et cetera, and activism around that.
Yes, and that the questions of feminist politics and queer politics, mm-hmm. class politics, is such an important part of this book.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, there's another great project that raises these questions about whose labor gets made visible is this work called Walmart Shop Dropping Project by Zoe Sheehan Saldana, where she will buy like a tank top at Walmart and then endeavor to reproduce it as exactly as possible by herself by hand. And then she returns her handmade version to Walmart and with the tag in place, and then it will be sold for $9.99 or whatever, even though she has spent hours and hours, many, many, many hours painstakingly reproducing. And they are virtually identical, but of course one of them, and then she takes a photo, and then she keeps the Walmart version and she exhibits it next to a photograph of the version that someone else has purchased. And it just, I think, raises so many interesting questions about precisely valuation, mystification, veiling, how textile production is just such an uneven terrain that is visible only in these these kind of jagged moments. And that I think a lot of artists are trying to really put pressure on.
I think that's one of the constant revelations in this book. It's not about trying to elevate the crafts into the fine arts or to make them commensurate in some way or to break the barriers down and say, really, they should all be on this level playing field without difference or hierarchical distinction. The distinctions and difference count. And it's not a binary opposition. It's a much more complicated, multivalent one.
Yeah, I mean, I think... I'm very happy to hear you say that. I do. I mean, one of the ways I could have written this book was to somehow interweave these cases, have somehow a section on Vicuña and then a section on the upper ears and go back to Vicuña. And I really thought that would have muddied the waters because I want them to have they are different. They have such different purposes. They have different forms. They have different audiences. I mean, maybe those audiences will one day converge. I mean, the Coquettes were absolutely a shambles of amateurism in their moment, and they were making costumes for themselves to wear while they were hanging out and doing drugs, and now there's shows, art museum shows, about the Coquettes and their costumes, but that was never their intent. So of course these, I can't predict what will happen to the Arpilleras. They're not really shown in art museums, and I say, it's important, they were not art. They were not in their moment art, and who cares? I'm interested in them and for other reasons, and I want them to be distinct, but I also want to give them equal space.
Maybe I can ask you one last question. And you read the sentence, and I didn't write the full sentence down, but you said that the central subject is how textiles mean where they should live institutionally and where they belong politically. Can I focus in on where they should live institutionally? If the Arpilleras are in a history of political memory or national histories, doesn't that frame them in a strict way that reduces their mobility?
Right.
So where do you think we can't move these objects around, they could be owned in groups by different institutions, mm-hmm. I suppose, but it's not easy for institutions to co-own works,
right.
nor to move them from site to site.
It's so timely that you asked this because last weekend I was in LA for the Radical Women Show, and I was which is a really important and amazing breakthrough show about women artists in Latin America from 65 to 85. And I participated in a workshop at the Hammer with the curators maybe 4 years ago when it was being developed. And I told the curators, I mean, Cecilia Vicuña's in the show and some, you know, many, many other artists. And I said, you know, I'm working on this book about textiles, and I have this, there's this massive archive of these fascinating textiles that are can be very hard-hitting, you know, about torture, but with tiny dolls. It's explosively interesting. And one of the curators looked into it, and then I ran into her several years later. She's like, we are gonna have arpilleras in the show. And which thrilled me. I mean, I cannot tell you how much it thrilled me to think about them being promiscuous precisely in that way and moving because they should, you know, and being redefined and finding different audiences. And so I went with such, I mean, I even like forced my publisher, this book is not officially out yet. These are like preview copies, like shipped directly from China. And I was like, you have to have my book at the opening of Radical Women because the arpilleras, I mean, this is amazing. It's gonna be in an art context next to Cecilia, you know, next to Vicuña, we have to do this. And there's copies there. And I walked around the show with every corner with a hopeful look on my face, like, and then there will be the arpilleras and they're not there. I don't know what happened, but they are not in the show. And I have to say, I was really disappointed because I thought it would have, I mean, just, you know, would have been a very interesting conversation to have, mm-hmm. formally, to have them next to the really more, you know, to have next to photo and video-based work, which is a lot of what the show is. So, oh well. Next time.
This is all speculation. Do you think if they could have found one, identified a woman who, and you mentioned some.
They could have so easy. Just ask me. They could have. I mean, there wasn't.
So they could have.
They so easily could have. They could have found an author. They yes. could have found an author for sure. Yeah. I mean, the show. I think the show is not interested in the folkloric, which these have at all. And it's trying to make a formal argument that is about what we might call advanced practices. So I think it would have. I don't know. I mean, I should ask. I was too kind of stunned to ask the curators what happened there. You know, it was just because I was so. And I kept thinking, like, maybe I missed it. I went twice through the whole thing. I was like, maybe there was like a secret room that I didn't see, you know? Like, where are they? But then I'll ask. I will have the conversation. But I think they wanted very insistently to make a political point about feminist Latin American work not being
Regressive,
you know, and I think these just had that whiff. You know, I think that they just can't, even though there's some of them are so formally innovative and they could have found an author so easily in a second, they could have done that. Yeah, it's a mystery.
Well, I think your term promiscuous is a great one. I think works of art are and can be, and the mobility of a work of art provides more readings, keeps it alive, and keeps it in the discourse, in the fray, in a way that's enormously productive. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Lynn, and thank you all for coming.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.